Well, thank you for that introduction, Michael, and thank you to the Tara and Virla and her whole staff for putting this event together. It's an incredible honor to be here and to have a little exchange in this kind of intimate setting. I think it's a really meaningful experience. In preparation for this event, I read your Optical Illusions, which you hadn't read since 1999, but which I've read like every month since 1999, and Three American Painters, the introduction to Three American Painters again. And I noticed in reading them closely together that there seemed to be a kind of discrepancy between the two. Not a contradiction by any means or an opposition, but a kind of discrepancy in which in the latter essay you discussed things like the layered impactedness, mobile intensiveness, and experiential density of Pollock's works. And you seem to emphasize or stress...
In the later essay,
the materiality of those works in a way that you hadn't in the earlier essay, where your concern was more to articulate, you know, the illusion of spatiality rendered in what you called optical terms, which I still think is kind of valid in the sense that you are contrasting that with what you could call the illusionism of spatiality rendered in tactile terms of old master painting.
And a la de Kooning, for example.
Exactly. And then you offer some classic descriptions of that illusion of spatiality rendered in optical terms. Among the things you say, for instance, of Pollock's work is that there's a homogeneous visual fabric that invites the act of looking but gives the eye nowhere to rest once and for all. And in a discussion of Pollock's line, when you describe it as delimiting eyesight alone, it is within the context of you suggesting that he has somehow made line autonomous from its traditional role of bounding shape or describing contours. And I think that that holds as well. And then you say, of course, that it is as if he has rendered materiality sheerly visible, which for some reason people like to attack you for. I'm not quite sure because it seems to be an apt description of that space anyway.
Certainly at a certain distance.
At a certain distance from the standard viewing distance that you would be able to take in the picture as a whole. And then in your discussion of that, or in your descriptions of that kind of space, you offer a description of figuration. Your main thesis is that Pollock is driven by the desire to preserve or maintain a sense of figuration within the context of an all-over style that seems to negate or be absolutely opposed to that figuration. And the two key paintings you key in on here are Cut Out of 1948 and Out of the Web.
Yeah, and before that, White Cockatoo.
And before
Summertime.
That, White, yeah, exactly. Yeah. As if he had paid too high a price in autonomizing line, but wanted to somehow preserve the traditional role of line or traditional role of figuration within a pictorial space. And the descriptions that you have of that figuration are very, very striking, right? This is where you begin to talk about the fact that figuration in Pollock appears as a kind of absence of a portion of the visual field. And I think you even say something about there being the feeling of a blind spot in your eyes or a defect of your retina that accounts for the figuration.
And especially in Out of the Web, it's hard to focus on.
Yes, the way that those figures are cut out from the ground, but that there is still some of that material kind of adhering to the masonite.
And they seem almost to be moving.
Exactly. I mean, it feels like they're floating in the space as well. Yeah. But the description made me think that, or maybe implicit in that description, was a kind of thesis of an almost radical continuity between the pictorial effects that Pollock intended to produce and the perceptual experience of the viewer before the work of art. And this kind of radical continuity in your version of it is very interesting to me because it seems absolutely opposed to other versions of continuity which don't seem as productive. So for instance, I'm thinking of someone like Anton Ehrensvärd, although there's numerous people who do this, which who argues that, you know, in Pollock's work, the self is lost in a kind of dissolution, an oceanic dissolution of the self within a pictorial space where the surface gestalt lies in ruins, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This kind of absolutely immersive, absorption into the painting that defeats selfhood. And I find that your account still preserves a moment of separation or distance, right?
Totally crucial.
That there has to be some moment in which the notion of immersion or absorption turns over into a specular, distant separateness. And I think you pursue this, you know, most recently, the terms that have helped me think about this was the Caravaggio book. But I was wondering, just given that kind of brief outline of your argument in that essay, if we could look at this painting, and if you could forward to the next painting. This is number 28, 1950, in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And then I think the next slide actually has them, you know, compared to one another. If in number 28, I tend to think, if you could go back to the large version of that, that there is a way in which these black skeins of paint on the surface of the painting create a kind of, they're much more reflective in person than they are in this reproduction, and it seems to create a kind of virtual plane that exists between the viewer and what might be an atmospheric depth beyond or on the notional other side of the plane defined by those black reflective enamel throws, which were put on last or very near last. So I was just wondering if we could maybe discuss the issues of separation and continuity in terms of your other claim for Pollock's work that it has a kind of manifest facingness, right? How do those two kind of concepts of the pictorial effects that seem to exist as if in one's own body turn over into a distant relationship between the viewer and the work of art, and how that works in terms of your idea of the facingness of his work?
Yeah, those, I mean, tough issues, great questions. If I go back to the blind spot, I mean, idea, this is where we don't see. I mean, I want to take very seriously the metaphorical structure of that. You know, it is as if.
Yeah, as it, which
right.
You have.
Which is totally crucial. So, you know, another way of putting it, it before it gets to that, it says it is where we don't see. Mm-hmm. So, the it's as if the blind spot, in the end, is so far as one wants to push that, wants to work with that metaphor, and since I do, it's as if the blind spot is there, out there. I mean, in a way that you understand perfectly, the last thing in the world I ever want to do is collapse the distance between the viewer and the painting. Yes. The last thing in the world I would ever want to do is do anything that smacked the least little bit of affect theory
yes.
or, you know, any of the kinds of theoretical nuttiness that marks this particular moment. So for me, the separation of the viewer from whatever the viewer is looking at, including works of art, is just going to be absolute and fundamental. I mean, you know that. So that what one's talking about all the time is something like pictorial effects.
Yeah.
And these effects are, as it were in the painting, activated by the viewer, experienced by the viewer, but not in the form of collapsing a distance between your, indeed, you know, one. I want to insist with Pollock that, however, Pollock's paintings, a painting like this one, or a painting like, but say certainly a painting like this one, or number one, 1948, draws one up close. Right? At some point in the I was in front of this painting in the Met just within the last couple of weeks. You want to see what's happening on the surface. You want to see what the tiny flecks of paint are doing. You want to pick up the slight swelling of the lines. You want to see what lies over what, right? And that's not so different. I was looking the other day. I went to the Louvre to see Valentin, and a certain amount of the time I was 4 inches from the picture surface. You know, looking absolutely closely at what the paint was doing in the Valentin. But looking at Valentin and looking at Pollock, it in the end are very similar in that then you back up. And for me, the experience of backing up to the point where I am seeing something that I want to call the painting as a whole is absolutely crucial. And I would want to say that that's sort of the decisive moment in our tradition for, you know, for looking at and evaluating paintings. There's a negotiation that's going to take place, right? It's not that there's ever a fixed distance. But however much a painting draws you in and you look closely, and that's priceless. I mean, what's actually a fantastically interesting, to me, phenomenological fact is that you go up close, and this could be any kind of painting, but certainly can be Pollock, and you see, but really, we did this in museums. You go up and you look absolutely closely at how something's made, and then you back up to a distance where it may seem as if you could no longer see that, but it's absolutely operative in your perceptions. You know, you're seeing it differently than you did before you did that. And I think that's just true, and that's one of the things one learns to do looking at paintings. So for me, the distanced viewing of Pollock is always crucial. I mean, and this used to come up almost amusingly, right, in some of the discussions about the issue of opticality, where someone would say, up to the distance of 3 feet, I mean, it's just completely material. And you want to say, yeah, up to the distance of 3 feet, fine. You know, you're happy with that, be happy with that. But you don't actually stand just 3 feet from number one, 1948. Sure. You know.
And the perception of materiality at that distance is still a visual perception of the materiality.
It's a visual perception of the material.
You know, I completely hear what you're saying, but it also seems to remind me of to get back to the discussion that you had about it's as if there's a blind spot mm-hmm. in your eye. It speaks to the difference between something that is a real effect, an illusion, like the illusion that you are having a blind spot in your eye is a real effect, versus illusionism, you know, which is a kind of trick, or at least an old master painting, it might be considered a kind of trick. So in essence, you know, illusionism is the way things are. I mean, illusion is the way things are. Illusionism is the way things aren't. So in your description of this kind of optical effect, there is a way to recuperate a kind of materialist vision from that insight that I don't think people really accept very much, or you know, maybe it's not apparent to them that there's a kind of insistence on the realism of that illusion.
I agree with that completely, and indeed, I mean, if we're looking at Out of the Web, I mean, it's a stunning picture, but the materiality of that surface is so real. It's not that one is imagining that there's something that denies that and occludes it and obscures it. What's fascinating is, in all its reality, as you sense the scraping of the knife and the bits of paint that's left, nevertheless, the pictorial effect is one of something like what we don't see, something that's missing, a kind of radical surgery on Pollock's part as a way of achieving a kind of figuration that would be compatible with this all-over style. I mean, it's also true that that very strong stress on opticality, space of vision alone, first written in 1964, comes out of, at that point, you know, relatively unexamined proximity to Greenberg mm-hmm. And to certain things in Greenberg's criticism. By the time I get to the year 66, 67, and with Shape as Form and the Lewis essay itself, and ending, of course, that year with Art and Objecthood, Nothing is more important to me than to put daylight between myself and Greenberg. But at the beginning, that's not the case. And then, to just get back to another point that you raised, by the time I write the Pollock's Intensity in 1989, I'm responding already to lots of the criticism. And indeed, when I, to go back and look at the earlier thing and renders the materiality sheerly optical, there's something to all or nothing about that. There's something to, I want to complicate it. I want to enrich it. I want to, set up at least a paragraph which is not, as it were, can I say, reneging on the basic vision, but at least is acknowledging that it was, that it's more complex than what that earlier writing said.
Well, I mean, just to end up on my time, and then we can pass it off. But I mean, I hear what you're saying in terms of the adherence to Greenberg. But I was also recently rereading Towards a Newer Lacan, when he's talking a lot about the relationship between materiality and what he calls plastic sight, mm-hmm. right? So all of that in the service of a kind of plastic sight, and his argument in a nutshell is essentially that abstract expressionist painters are using materiality or stressing the opacity of the medium in a way that counteracts the medium in some way, puts some kind of critical check on just the stuffness of the painting. And so I still find a compelling argument between those two.
Oh, I'm sure you're right. I mean, and as you know, I mean, Greenberg is not always on all fours with everything else in Greenberg. Right. But that moment around the 60s, Greenberg, dealing himself with Lewis and Noland, and then in After Abstract Expressionism, trying to talk about the Newman still, not Pollock there, but, this new painting that's oriented to the primacy of color, as he puts it. He actually doesn't talk there about opticality. The phrase he uses, I talk about this in the introduction to Art and Object, he talks about openness a lot.
Yeah.
That's a very key term. I mean, the great thing about, this would now raise another issue in contemporary art, which goes along with the denigration of color field, and that is, to me, this almost like literally insane desire for continuous posthumous revenge against Clement Greenberg. I've actually had the thought that, applying to the Mellon Foundation, but maybe the Terra Foundation is the way to go, because it is American. The proposal would be that we set out an announcement so that everyone understands this, and we dig up whatever remains of Greenberg. And we have a great big public event. We do what sort of the Stuarts did with Oliver Cromwell. And we hang the skeleton and we behead it and we burn it. And then everyone who wants to, everyone who is like totally committed to October can come and urinate on the fire. And then it's over. We get past it, right? There's been a sort of orgy of public revenge. And then we can move into this new world in which, once again, Greenberg could be read as if he were just a critic, instead of just this malign, evil force that controlled the entire New York art world, which is completely crazy. What Greenberg wanted to do was control people's lives. He was not a nice man. He was absolutely interested in control. But it wasn't the art world that he wanted to control. It was somebody wanted somebody to leave his wife. That's what Greenberg wanted. Right? So control is right, but not anything as abstract as the art world. This is simply to say that Greenberg remains, yes, a kind of completely interesting critic. And I think I had latched on to probably, in somewhat simplified version of his views at that moment. But for me, the notion of something like eyesight alone, which is probably very much even more than anything in painting coming out of the modern sculpture. Essay. For me it was useful to think with, right? I mean, heuristically, I could do things with it. In retrospect, it feels too simple. I think that's right. It doesn't lead to I'm glad that you feel that there's, some virtue to that way of thinking about what's going on in the Pollock. The idea of looking at the Pollocks at a distance is really important.